I'd like to do is I want to talk about those two steps from my perspective. I think of all the steps that people have some trouble, really getting to those two steps, and I'll share my ideas about it and my experience, actually, with those steps, because I think they're really crucial. And then if we have time, I'll open the floor to questions. Every time that I pick up the big book on this step and then go to the 12 and 12, I think that if there is ever a place where you see that Bill has grown and changed, there are a couple of steps, particularly. That's just my opinion. 6 and 7 are two of them. You know, I think what we have to remember is when that big book was written, I realize Bill had a white light experience. That doesn't entitle you to, that's a white light experience. And any of those spiritual experiences, if you study the writings of the mystics and you study the writings of the saints, those experiences are given for a purpose. And that experience achieved its purpose. I don't think it made a great spiritual, gave Bill a whole lot of spiritual insight necessarily. Because it always strikes me when you look at step 6 and 7 in the big book, it's about 12 lines. And when you pick up the 12 and 12, which he wrote when he was 13 or 14 years sober, sometime in there, you get a whole different picture. What do we do with this stuff? What do we do with the character defects? I've heard all kinds of things. And I can tell you, if I've had experience on anything, it was that business because of my monastic experience. The experience that I had with people who had studied theology like I had and who had an idea of what was to happen with these defects that we had. In this book, Bill basically says, after we have done our 4 and 5, you know, it's very simple. He says, if we can say to our satisfaction, answer, we then look at step 6. We've emphasized willingness. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all things which we have admitted are objectionable? Well, it's easy to say, yeah, I'm ready. The fact is, I was willing to come to Las Vegas 2 or 3 months ago. But I was not ready until my suitcase was closed up and I took my key and locked the door. I can say I'm ready, but am I really ready? Because if I'm going to live without those things we call our character defects, see, I think we give that stuff names, and I think what really happens is as we go through step 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, we begin to see ourselves different. We begin to see ourselves different from the way we saw ourselves when we came in. And we begin to see that all is not well. That I do things that I want to do or I don't want to do, and I've got to make changes, and we call those things character defects. How am I going to live with those things? So Bill says, are you ready to have them removed? And then he says, can he take them all, every one? Well, sure, it's easy to say yes. But if those things are going to be taken, I have to live without them because they are my method for getting along in the world. You see? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. I don't have any problem with that. I just think that it has to be looked at because it just isn't the way it happens. See, I just took a few things from my fourth step with my dad. And column two. One of the things that I resented in favor of the boys. But we can take it. Sometimes he was cranky and stern. And I didn't like that. I didn't like the fact that my dad was a farmer. I'm no longer surprised when I misbehave. I can tell you that. And one of the things that I've learned through this process is, you think that's funny, you're sick. My father and mother came from the States in the early 1900s. They were pioneers, and they had really nothing. And my father's family was in L.A. and in Minneapolis, and for some reason he had an adventuresome spirit, and he wanted to farm, and he came to the prairies, and the Catholic Church had been given a big grant of land, and you could get 160 acres free and clear in 10 years if you came and opened it. And so with two oxen and a plow and my mother, they came to Saskatchewan. By the time I came along, my father was a wealthy man. You know, when I think about that, what it took for them in ingenuity and effort and discipline and courage and the whole business, and by the time, as I said, I came along, he was a wealthy man. That didn't matter to me. I had an uncle who lived in town. He had a dealership, and my father could probably have bought him with petty cash. That didn't matter. He wore a suit. He was in the city, and he had a dealership, and my father was a farmer. You see, you get to see how you think, and you begin to see how that affects the way you do life. Those kinds of phony ideas were with me for a long, long time. Step four wants to come back. Now, the interesting thing is that then he says, we take a look at what part of our life was affected by the things. There was more in this column. I just put a few things. What I found was my personal relations were affected. When I did the steps at 18 years, the person who took me through the steps said, get in touch with how you see the world. Get in touch with your thinking process. And what I found out was, sure, it affected my personal relations. Why? Because my father is a farmer. I look down on him. I look down on myself. And that's the way I do personal relations. So I've got to find somebody who's going to make me okay. And therefore, I sell my soul. And then you begin to see how you operate. He favored the boys. And I can tell you that affected my personal relations. You know, people say, well, I don't know how to do relationship. Well, I'm pretty good at relationship these days. I didn't used to be. But I think relationship means if I'm going to relate to you, I've got to get out of myself. I've got to get past my little petty wants and have the capacity to have some compassion for you. I used to think that I was sensitive. I was, like I said this morning, I wasn't sensitive. I was self-absorbed. I was self-obsessed. That's what I was. And how are you going to have a relationship with anybody when it's all about me? And then if you get somebody into your life who is also self-obsessed, you might as well take out the 357 Magnums and go right to it. Get it over with. Because there's going to be war in that household. You see? And I think that that is one of the things that this whole process, I began to see that my security was affected, you see? And my security was affected because I didn't think, the way I looked at that whole system, I'm a girl, and I did not understand how all that affected, that I thought I was second rate because I'm a girl. I'll never get the kind of opportunities that men get. And that fed partly into my going to a convent. You know, so life starts to make sense. I often find that when sponsees come in or people come for counseling, they feel their life is so complex. It's like they just can't make any kind of sense of it. And as you start this process of unraveling, you really get to see what's going on and why you make the kind of choices that you do and why you bring the kind of people into your life that you do and why relationships don't work, you see. So, and then, column four. Well, I never spoke up to my dad. When we do step eight in a little while, I'm going to talk about some of the findings, which I'm sure that you know as well as I do, but how childhood has really affected us. I was a scared kid, you know, and I sometimes wonder if we don't have past lives. And that we bring stuff because I can't ever remember not being scared. I can't ever remember not being full of fear and angry because the world was the way it was. You know, I can say, well, it was because of my sister Dora and because my brothers and sisters didn't fix her, and all that is true. And some old beliefs that I took on because of that. But basically, those were part of my defense mechanisms. I never spoke up to anybody. I never told anybody the truth. I never would have gone to my dad and said, I don't feel good when you're cranky or when you're stern. Instead, I already then began the process of the lying and the manipulating and the flattery and telling people what they wanted to hear so that they'd be happy, and if they were happy, then I could feel safe. And at the bottom of it was this rotten business of fear, always the fear that I'm not okay and I need you to make me okay. And so what did I do? I cowered. I told him lies to flatter him, because even at five, don't underestimate children. At five, I knew that I could tell my father things. I would go to him and I'd tell him, the priest said, you are the best man in the parish. He couldn't run the parish without him. Hadn't seen the priest. And the interesting part was my father would have known if he had thought about it, but his face would soften. I would tell him all kinds of stories about what people had said to him. My regard for the truth was nil. Because if it was going to change how somebody else was thinking and it was going to bring them into being happy with me, I would do it. I had no conscience about that kind of stuff. I never spoke the truth and, of course, spoke behind his back. Gossiped about him. Never said it to his face, but said it behind his back and so on. You see? Now, you could call those some of my character defects. My defense mechanisms, my ways of dealing with life, and how am I going to get rid of them? You know, I would remind you that in this book, in the 12 and 12, Bill says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. This is the step where we see the difference between a self-determined objective and the objective which is from God. When I read the 12 and 12, sometimes I want to cry because I hear the pain in Bill's soul when he says, why does the grace of God work 100% to take away our drinking problem, and it doesn't do it with our character defects? You see? Because if you were Bill Wilson, nobody has ever said this to me, but I have a feeling, you know, we hear all kinds of stories that Bill, you know, liked the chickies and all that. And I don't, if he did, I don't like him less because of that. I can relate to him. I don't relate to Dr. Bob so much. He's way too good for me. Way, you know, that business of getting sober and then I'm just going to go do 12-step work and I'm just going to go to the hospital and do 12-step work. Hell, I like a little trouble. So, you know, when I read that stuff that Bill liked the chickies, I think, you know, I like you, Bill. That's the way I am. I don't give in immediately. And, you know, if this is true, and I suspect it is from things that, and I don't care. Think about this. You are the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. You go to meetings and people are fawning all over you. Bill, you saved my life. Bill, you saved my life. And you know that you have your own little secret. I think I'd be depressed too. See, that's one of the reasons that he came to Saskatoon. I don't know if he, I guess Hoffer went to New York. But that's how I got hooked up with Dr. Hoffer, who had been hooked up with Bill. Because Bill thought maybe, you know, LSD would be helpful not just for himself but for others too. He was trying to find a way. How do you get done with your stuff? You know something? I don't know that. I'm going to go back to, I find that when I line up my character defects and I say I'm not going to do them again, I have just written a guarantee that I will do them again. What I find much more helpful is what I do every morning, and I've said it a number of times, is to remember who I am. I'm a God being. And it's my goal in life, if I say my third step prayer, to let God do something good through me today. Let God be helpful through me to pass love on to my brothers and sisters. And if I think that way, back that up with spiritual reading. You know, I don't know how people live without spiritual reading. My head is so full of theology still. It's full of everything from the race consciousness. It's full of the stuff of the body, the stuff of, you know, the human experience. To me, pulling out the spiritual reading is just amazing. And even with that, I don't pull it off sometimes. Because I think this is very much connected with step 8, where Bill talks about the stuff that we've taken on from childhood and the old messages. I can be peaceful and I can be totally in harmony with everything 1 minute, and somebody looks at me cross-eyed. You identify with that? And all of a sudden, the day is no longer sunny. And I'm feeling lousy. And now I've got to get into how I deal with that kind of stuff so that I can feel okay again. You see? So, here Bill says, well, we've already talked about the main problem rests in the mind, the old ideas, the old belief systems, the habits. You know, I wonder if we realize sometimes how much we are creatures of habit, and that the way we respond to people and certain people just looking at them disturbs me, and some people looking at them excites me. I'm looking your way, Mike. The root of the problem is self. See? You see, and you can't have God consciousness and self consciousness. And so, you see what happens. During the hurly-burly of the day, the God consciousness goes out the window, and the self-conscious, the self-centeredness comes back, and before I know it, I'm back to those old behavior patterns, which is really what they are. I'll tell you, in Toronto, there's a group. They have, at the front of the room, they have a page as big as that wall, I think. And on it, they've got listed 100 character defects. If I belonged to that group, I'd put a bullet through my head. Do I need to look at that crap? Because if I did, I'd soon be thinking, I got to do it. Because what you focus on is going to be uppermost in your mind. And before you know it, I know that I'm not saying that I don't have stuff, but it just doesn't work for me that way. See, we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. Now, let's take a look at what Bill says. You know where he says, we've separated the men from the boys. Well, I guess I'll get into this. I think that here in step six, we really experience ego deflation at depth. Like I said this morning, I'm not here to be good. And if there's one place where I find that I'm not in charge, it's right in this business of how I behave. I can manage as well as I want to. I can meditate in the morning and meditate at night and do my spiritual reading and practice the presence of God. And somewhere in that day, my life can still go off the rails. Because that's really how life is, I think. I didn't understand this process. And when I was sober a year, I got off Skid Row. I got a teaching job. And I was in a secondary school. And if you know anything about teenagers, they'll saw you off at the knees. They're not particular. And I was sensitive. And I hadn't taught for 4 or 5 years because I'd been drunk that whole time. And I was in a new field. And so I was emotionally disturbed. That's all I can say. I was not in a place where I was emotionally calm. And I was just at the place where I was starting starting the steps. No, I guess maybe I had done my 4 and 5. But anyway, I would go into school one day, and I would be just Mrs. AA. I was just wonderful. Just the way you would expect a perfect Mrs. AA to be. And then maybe the next day I'd go to school, and I'd be in a bad mood. And I'd hear the kids send the message down the hall, "She's in a bad mood today, be careful." How humiliating can it be? I mean, Mrs. AA shouldn't have to hear that kind of stuff. And so I didn't like it. And so I decided that I'm going to be done with this emotional up and down, this roller coaster. By this time, I had left the Catholic Church. But I'm not beyond whining. So I decided that I would stop at a Catholic church on the way to school. And I hadn't been in a church for a while, but I'd go into that church and I'd kneel down and I might even light a candle. And I would ask God, today I promise you I'm just going to do it right. I'm just going to go to school, and I'm going to get out of the car, and I'm just going to smile at everybody, and I'm just going to be emotionally stable. And you can bet your bottom dollar that in the degree that I said that's what I was going to do, I did the diametric opposite. Next day, back to church. Pray some more. And that's how that went. Until finally, I realized that's just trying to get my will done. That's not about trying to grow spiritually. And I was only a year sober, but I didn't understand. And then I got a sponsor who had a size 16 shoe. And he explained the business of life to me, that that is really not how you grow spiritually. You know, in this book, Bill talks about this, where he says, having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why then shouldn't we be able to achieve by the same means a perfect release from every other difficulty or defect? This is the riddle of our existence, the full answer to which may be only in the mind of God. Nevertheless, at least a part of the answer to it is apparent to us. Do you really want to be 100% free of lust? Thanks, Tom. Do you really want to be 100%? You know, some of this stuff, it sounds good. After you're sober a while and you've done a lot of spiritual reading and you've done a lot of meditating and a lot of change has taken place, some of this stuff sounds kind of desirable. But at the time I was working on this, I didn't want to be rid of 100% of that stuff. No wonder it couldn't be taken. I wanted to look good, you see. And so that isn't the way this is going to be removed. But, you know, the way Bill talks about it is, I think that those failures that we have in this business, they're partly the humiliation that is necessary for the destruction of the ego. If you've ever read any of Dr. Tebow's comments about this, he talks about just this very fact, that humiliation is part of what the process is for the destruction of the ego. And I don't think there's anything more humiliating than saying, I'm going to stop doing this and then keep on doing it. And, you know, if you're living in a family, that can be really devastating. Isn't that true? You say, I'm going to change, and then you don't change, and you keep doing the same old stuff. So, I haven't got any smart answers. I think that I'm very shortly going to open up the floor to questions and comments. I think of what St. Paul said, because I don't think this is just us who experience this. In one of his writings, St. Paul said, he talked about the sting of the flesh 2,000 years ago. And he said, the things that I want to do, I don't do. And the things that I don't want to do, I do. And, of course, a lot of people have jumped on that and think that St. Paul had a sexual problem. I don't know if he did or not, but I know he had the sting of the flesh, and I've got the sting of the flesh, because that's what happens to me sometimes. The things I want to do, I don't do, and the things I don't want to do, those are the things that I do. I think also, one more thing that I want to say is, two more things I want to say about this. I think this is where step six relates to step three. Like I said, I think the book is just so beautifully put together in terms of how we grow. in step three, where he says, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own. We had to have God's help. And I think this is where this carries over into step six, because we find out that just because I determine I'm uncomfortable with this, I want to change, I need to change, that's not going to be the process. The process is going to be the growth process, and that's going to involve that humiliation, which is going to bring us to step seven. See, another thing I think I've learned another mistake I think that people make is this. We forget this. I really believe this. You know, when I make this diagram, I really believe this. That deep within every man, woman, and child, and that means in me, is the fundamental idea of God. And I go back to what Chuck said when he said, you already are everything that you can be, because God lives within you, and therefore everything is right within you. I think we, in our humanity, in our humanness, have the idea that if I do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to become more pleasing to God. I think I'm as pleasing to God right now as I will ever be. If this is true, that God lives within me, then God is pleasing. I can bring light. Where there are people who are living in... Step seven starts out with a word that a lot of people aren't fond of. Humbly. I asked sponsees to bring me a definition of humbly. I didn't bring all the papers, because they went to all kinds of places and they found out all kinds of definitions. I think it's a very simple definition that St. Bernard of Clairvaux gave in the 4th century. He said, humility is the truth. That's simple. It has nothing to do with the obsequiousness of a Uriah Heep, as he is shown in one of Dickens' books. It has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with saying, I'm not important. It has nothing to do with saying, I can't do that. I'm small and I'm weak and I'm all kinds of things. I think what it has to do with is acknowledging who we are. And I don't care what program you practice, and I don't care where you go with this stuff. If you don't learn to find the presence of God within you, you've missed the boat. And if you find that presence within you, everything changes. Because then you stop the business of saying, I'm not good enough. Because if you look at the human world, there are always people I can find that I feel superior to, and I can always find people I feel inferior to. There are always going to be people who have more money than I do and less money, who have a bigger house and a smaller house, who have a better car and a lesser car, and so on. We can go if we're looking on the outside. If that's what you determine the importance of your life, it creates all kinds of problems. It creates all kinds of emotional upset. Whereas, if you really take to heart that question, who am I? Who am I? Do I really believe that I am made out of God? Do I believe that God is everything? Do I believe that God is my life and shows up as me? That this life force, if you like that better, however, whatever you want to call it. If that is the truth, a couple of things follow from that. I always tell sponsees, if you've got 100 this isn't about playing small. If you've got 100 cylinders available to you, then fire on 100 cylinders. Don't be satisfied to do 35. You know? got a whole raft of sponsees, business women and actresses and you know, people who are in the prime of their life. And sometimes they get the idea that the program means that they shouldn't move forward. If you can make $10 billion, make it. It's not about that. Because if you understand who you are, then you understand that everything flows from the source. Call it God, call it the life force, and everything comes from that place. The spider has no problem with that. You know, I love the spider. Because if you think about it, when he wants to spin a web, he doesn't run across the ceiling to find a spider and beat the tar out of another spider and get that spider's juice so he can spin a web. He wants to spin a web, he spins. Why? Because he knows it all comes from within. It all comes from within. And I love that story of the spider because he's looked after. I didn't know this till just recently. But he builds a sticky web, and that's how he gets his food. And insects get stuck on that sticky web. And you can say, well, how come he doesn't get stuck on it? He's got to go get his food. Think how the great reality has taken care of that little spider. Because there is a secretion on his legs that allows him to run across his sticky web, pick up those poor little insects that got stuck there, have his lunch, and go right back. And I don't know about you, but I love that. I love to think of the spider. On the farm, I remember when I was a kid, rabbits came around. Come November, probably November, toward the end of November, the rabbits that were brown were now white. How did that happen? The horses that had a very sleek coat grew a heavier coat. How did that happen? See, it all came from within. And I think that really, to me, is the message of humility. That it's not humble. If you do a great job and somebody says to you, you did a great job, Luther. And Luther says, well, not really. You know, I didn't know. Thank you, Bob. But if you recognize, I'm telling you, I believe that spiritual truth and spiritual awakeness just make life so much easier. You tell me I did a good job. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm no better or any worse because you tell me that if I did my best, that's what's required of me. You know, and the one thing, last thing I want to mention, Bill talks about character building, and in reference to material achievement. And he says, we do not deprecate material achievement. You see, like I said, if you've got 100 cylinders, let them all fire and have some fun and make something of yourself. And if you've got the right consciousness, that's wonderful. He says, however, be careful that you don't go for character building because it's good business. Because, you know, if I have good character and people know I can be trusted, they'll give me the contract instead of somebody else. That's not the motivation. And I think often we have to look at our motivation. And I can tell you this, if your motivation is to grow in God consciousness, you'll never be wrong. You'll never be wrong. It'll always lead you on a path that will lead you to a better way of experience. So, we have a few minutes left.